responsive to her cousin's voice, Phoebe heard that strange, vague murmur, which might be likened to an indistinct shadow of human utterance. 7. The Guest. When Phoebe awoke, which she did with the early twittering of the conjugal couple of robins in the pear tree, she heard movements below stairs, and, hastening down, found Hepzibah already in the kitchen. She stood by the window, holding a book in close contiguity to her nose, as if with the hope of gaining an olfactory acquaintance with its contents, since her imperfect vision made it not very easy to read them. If any volume could have manifested its essential wisdom in the mode suggested, it would certainly have been the one now in Hepzibah's hand, and the kitchen in such an event would forthwith have steamed with the fragrance of venison, turkeys, capons, larded partridges, puddings, cakes, and Christmas pies, in all manner of elaborate mixture and concoction. It was a cookery book, full of innumerable old fashions of English dishes, and illustrated with engravings which represented the arrangements of the table at such banquets as it might have befitted a nobleman to give in the great hall of his castle. And amid these rich and potent devices of the culinary art, not one of which probably had been tested within the memory of any man's grandfather, poor Hepzibah was seeking for some nimble little tidbit, which with what skill she had and such materials as were at hand she might toss up for breakfast. Soon, with a deep sigh, she put aside the savory volume, and inquired of Phoebe whether old Speckle, as she called one of the hens, had laid an egg the preceding day. Phoebe ran to see, but returned without the expected treasure in her hand. At that instant, however, the blast of a fish-dealer's conch was heard, announcing his approach along the street. With energetic raps at the shop window, Hepzibah summoned the man in and made purchase of what he warranted as the finest mackerel in his cart, and as fat a one as ever he felt with his finger so early in the season. Requesting Phoebe to roast some coffee, which she casually observed was the real mocha, and so long kept that each of the small berries ought to be worth its weight in gold, the maiden lady heaped fuel into the vast receptacle of the ancient fireplace in such quantity as soon to drive the lingering dusk out of the kitchen. The country girl, willing to give her utmost assistance, proposed to make an Indian cake after her mother's peculiar method of easy manufacture, and which she could vouch for as possessing a richness, and if rightly prepared, a delicacy unequalled by any other mode of breakfast cake. Hepzibah gladly assenting, the kitchen was soon the scene of savory preparation. Perchance, amid their proper element of smoke, which eddied forth from the ill-constructed chimney, the ghosts of departed cookmaids looked wonderingly on or peeped down the great breadth of the flue, despising the simplicity of the projected meal, yet ineffectually pining to thrust their shadowy hands into each inchoate dish. The half-starved rats, at any rate, stole visibly out of their hiding-places and sat on their hind legs, snuffing the fumy atmosphere and wistfully awaiting an opportunity to nibble. Hepzibah had no natural turn for cookery, and to say the truth had fairly incurred her present meagerness by often choosing to go without her dinner, rather than be attendant on the rotation of the spit or ebullition of the pot. Her zeal over the fire, therefore, was quite an heroic test of sentiment. It was touching and positively worthy of tears, if Phoebe, the only spectator, except for the rats and ghosts aforesaid, had not been better employed than in shedding them, to see her rake out a bed of fresh and glowing coals and proceed to broil the mackerel. Her usually pale cheeks were all ablaze with heat and hurry. She watched the fish with as much tender care and minuteness of attention as if, we know not how to express it otherwise, as if her own heart were on the gridiron, and her immortal happiness were involved in its being done precisely to a turn. Life within doors has few pleasanter prospects than a neatly arranged and well-provisioned breakfast table. We come to it freshly, in the dewy youth of the day, and when our spiritual and sensual elements are in better accord than at a later period, so that the material delights of the morning meal are capable of being fully enjoyed, without any very grievous reproaches, whether gastric or conscientious, for yielding even a trifle overmuch to the animal department of our nature. The thoughts, too, that run around the ring of familiar guests have a piquancy and mirthfulness and oftentimes a vivid truth, which more rarely find their way into the elaborate intercourse of dinner. Hepzibah's small and ancient table, supported on its slender and graceful legs and covered with a cloth of the richest damask, looked worthy to be the scene and center of one of the cheerfulest of parties. The vapor of the broiled fish arose like incense from the shrine of a barbarian idol, while the fragrance of the mocha might have gratified the nostrils of a tutelary lar, or whatever power has scope over a modern breakfast table. Phoebe's Indian cakes were the sweetest offering of all, in their hue befitting the rustic altars of the innocent and golden age, or so brightly yellow were they, resembling some of the bread which was changed to glistening gold when Midas tried to eat it. The butter must not be forgotten, butter which Phoebe herself had churned in her own rural home and brought it to her cousin as a propitiatory gift, smelling of clover blossoms and diffusing the charm of pastoral scenery through the dark-paneled parlor. All this, with the quaint gorgeousness of the old china cups and saucers, and the crested spoons, and a silver cream jug, Hepzibah's only other article of plate, and shaped like the rudest porringer, set out a board at which the stateliest of old Colonel Pynchon's guests need not have scorned to take his place. But the Puritan's face scowled down out of the picture as if nothing on the table pleased his appetite. By way of contributing what grace she could, Phoebe gathered some roses and a few other flowers, possessing either scent or beauty, and arranged them in a glass pitcher, which, having long ago lost its handle, was so much the fitter for a flower vase. The early sunshine, as fresh as that which peeped into Eve's bower while she and Adam sat at breakfast there, came twinkling through the branches of the pear tree and fell quite across the table. All was now ready. There were chairs and plates for three. A chair and plate for Hepzibah, the same for Phoebe. But what other guest did her cousin look for? Throughout this preparation there had been a constant tremor in Hepzibah's frame, an agitation so powerful that Phoebe could see the quivering of her gaunt shadow as thrown by the firelight on the kitchen wall or by the sunshine on the parlor floor. Its manifestations were so various and agreed so little with one another that the girl knew not what to make of it. Sometimes it seemed an ecstasy of delight and happiness. At such moments, Hepzibah would fling out her arms and enfold Phoebe in them and kiss her cheek as tenderly as ever her mother had. She appeared to do so by an inevitable impulse, and as if her bosom were oppressed with tenderness of which she must needs pour out a little in order to gain breathing room. The next moment, without any visible cause for the change, her unwonted joy shrank back, appalled, as it were, and clothed itself in mourning. Or it ran and hid itself, so to speak, in the dungeon of her heart, where it had long lain chained, while a cold spectral sorrow took the place of the imprisoned joy that was afraid to be enfranchised, a sorrow as black as that was bright. She often broke into a little nervous hysteric laugh, more touching than any tears could be, and forthwith, as if to try which was the most touching, a gush of tears would follow. Or perhaps the laughter and tears came both at once, and surrounded our poor Hepzibah in a moral sense with a kind of pale, dim rainbow. Towards Phoebe, as we have said, she was affectionate, far tenderer than ever before in their brief acquaintance, except for that one kiss on the preceding night. Yet with a continually recurring pettishness and irritability, she would speak sharply to her, then, throwing aside all the starched reserve of her ordinary manner, ask pardon, and the next instant renew the just forgiven injury. At last, when their mutual labor was all finished, she took Phoebe's hand in her own trembling one.
"Bear with me, my dear child," she cried, "for truly my heart is full to the brim. Bear with me, for I love you, Phoebe, though I speak so roughly. Think nothing of it, dearest child. by and by I shall be kind and only kind. "My dearest cousin, cannot you tell me what has happened?" asked Phoebe, with a sunny and tearful sympathy. "What is it that moves you so? Hush! Hush!" "He is coming," whispered Hepzibah, hastily wiping her eyes. "Let him see you first, Phoebe, for you are young and rosy and cannot help letting a smile break out, whether or no. He always liked bright faces, and mine is old now, and the tears are hardly dry on it. He never could abide tears. There, draw the curtain a little so that the shadow may fall across his side of the table. But let there be a good deal of sunshine, too, for he never was fond of gloom, as some people are. He has had but little sunshine in his life, poor Clifford. And, oh, what a black shadow! Poor, poor Clifford!"
Thus murmuring in an undertone, as if speaking rather to her own heart than to Phoebe, the old gentlewoman stepped on tiptoe about the room, making such arrangements as suggested themselves at the crisis. Meanwhile there was a step in the passageway above stairs. Phoebe recognized it as the same which had passed upward as through her dream in the night-time. The approaching guest, whoever it might be, appeared to pause at the head of the staircase. He paused twice or thrice in the descent. He paused again at the foot. Each time the delay seemed to be without purpose, but rather from a forgetfulness of the purpose which had set him in motion, or as if the person's feet came involuntarily to a standstill because the motive power was too feeble to sustain his progress. Finally he made a long pause at the threshold of the parlour. He took hold of the knob of the door, then loosened his grasp without opening it. Hepzibah, her hands convulsively clasped, stood gazing at the entrance.
"Dear Cousin Hepzibah, pray don't look so," said Phoebe, trembling,
for her cousin's emotion and this mysteriously reluctant step made her feel as if a ghost were coming into the room.
"You really frighten me. Is something awful going to happen?"
"Hush," whispered Hepzibah.
"Be cheerful. Whatever may happen, be nothing but cheerful."
The final pause at the threshold proved so long that Hepzibah, unable to endure the suspense, rushed forward, threw open the door, and led in the stranger by the hand. At the first glance, Phoebe saw an elderly personage in an old-fashioned dressing gown of faded damask, and wearing his gray or almost white hair of an unusual length. It quite overshadowed his forehead, except when he thrust it back and stared vaguely about the room. After a very brief inspection of his face, it was easy to conceive that his footstep must necessarily be such an one as that which, slowly and with as indefinite an aim as a child's first journey across a floor, had just brought him hitherward. Yet there were no tokens that his physical strength might not have sufficed for a free and determined gait. It was the spirit of the man that could not walk. The expression of his countenance, while notwithstanding it had the light of reason in it, seemed to waver and glimmer and nearly to die away, and feebly to recover itself again. It was like a flame which we see twinkling among half-extinguished embers. We gaze at it more intently than if it were a positive blaze gushing vividly upward, more intently, but with a certain impatience, as if it ought either to kindle itself into satisfactory splendor or be at once extinguished. For an instant after entering the room, the guest stood still, retaining Hepzibah's hand instinctively, as a child does that of the grown person who guides it. He saw Phoebe, however, and caught an illumination from her youthful and pleasant aspect, which indeed threw a cheerfulness about the parlour, like the circle of reflected brilliancy around the glass vase of flowers that was standing in the sunshine. He made a salutation, or, to speak nearer the truth, an ill-defined abortive attempt at courtesy. Imperfect as it was, however, it conveyed an idea, or at least gave a hint, of indescribable grace, such as no practiced art of external manners could have attained. It was too slight to seize upon at the instant, yet, as recollected afterwards, seemed to transfigure the whole man.
"Dear Clifford," said Hepzibah, in the tone with which one soothes a wayward infant, "this is our cousin Phoebe, little Phoebe Pynchon, Arthur's only child, you know. She has come from the country to stay with us a while, for our old house has grown to be very lonely now.
Phoebe? Phoebe Pynchon? Phoebe?
Repeated the guest, with a strange, sluggish, ill-defined utterance.
Arthur's child? Ah, I forget. No matter. She is very welcome.
Come, dear Clifford, take this chair, said Hepzibah, leading him to his place. Pray, Phoebe, lower the curtain a very little more.
Now, let us begin breakfast.
The guest seated himself in the place assigned him and looked strangely around. He was evidently trying to grapple with the present scene and bring it home to his mind with a more satisfactory distinctness. He desired to be certain, at least, that he was here in the low-studded, cross-beamed, oaken-paneled parlour, and not in some other spot which had stereotyped itself into his senses. But the effort was too great to be sustained with more than a fragmentary success. Continually, as we may express it, he faded away out of his place. Or, in other words, his mind and consciousness took their departure, leaving his wasted gray and melancholy figure a substantial emptiness, a material ghost, to occupy his seat at table. Again, after a blank moment, there would be a flickering taper gleam in his eyeballs. It betokened that his spiritual part had returned and was doing its best to kindle the heart's household fire and light up intellectual lamps in the dark and ruinous mansion where it was doomed to be a forlorn inhabitant. At one of these moments of less torpid yet still imperfect animation, Phoebe became convinced of what she had at first rejected as too extravagant and startling an idea. She saw that the person before her must have been the original of the beautiful miniature in her cousin Hepzibah's possession. Indeed, with a feminine eye for costume, she had at once identified the damask dressing gown which enveloped him as the same in figure, material, and fashion with that so elaborately represented in the picture. This old faded garment, with all its pristine brilliancy extinct, seemed in some indescribable way to translate the wearer's untold misfortune and make it perceptible to the beholder's eye. It was the better to be discerned by this exterior type how worn and old were the soul's more immediate garments. That form and countenance, the beauty and grace of which had almost transcended the skill of the most exquisite of artists, it could the more adequately be shown that the soul of the man must have suffered some miserable wrong from its earthly experience. There he seemed to sit with a dim veil of decay and ruin betwixt him and the world, but through which at flitting intervals might be caught the same expression, so refined, so softly imaginative, which Malbone, venturing a happy touch with suspended breath, had imparted to the miniature. There had been something so innately characteristic in this look that all the dusky years and the burden of unfit calamity which had fallen upon him did not suffice utterly to destroy it. Hepzibah had now poured out a cup of deliciously fragrant coffee and presented it to her guest. As his eyes met hers, he seemed bewildered and disquieted.
"Is this you, Hepzibah?" he murmured sadly.
Then, more apart and perhaps unconscious that he was overheard,
"How changed, how changed! And is she angry with me? Why does she bend her brow so?"
Poor Hepzibah! It was that wretched scowl, which time and her near-sightedness and the fret of inward discomfort had rendered so habitual that any vehemence of mood invariably evoked it. But at the indistinct murmur of his words her whole face grew tender and even lovely, with sorrowful affection. The harshness of her features disappeared, as it were, behind the warm and misty glow.
"Angry," she repeated. "Angry with you, Clifford?"
Her tone, as she uttered the exclamation, had a plaintive and really exquisite melody thrilling through it, yet without subduing a certain something which an obtuse auditor might still have mistaken for asperity. It was as if some transcendent musician should draw a soul-thrilling sweetness out of a cracked instrument, which makes its physical imperfection heard in the midst of ethereal harmony. So deep was the sensibility that found an organ in Hepzibah's voice.
"There is nothing but love here, Clifford," she added. "Nothing but love. You are at home."
The guest responded to her tone by a smile, which did not half light up his face. Feeble as it was, however, and gone in a moment, it had a charm of wonderful beauty. It was followed by a coarser expression, or one that had the effect of coarseness on the fine mold and outline of his countenance, because there was nothing intellectual to temper it. It was a look of appetite. He ate food with what might almost be termed voracity, and seemed to forget himself, Hepzibah, the young girl, and everything else around him, in the sensual enjoyment which the bountifully spread table afforded. In his natural system, though high-wrought and delicately refined, a sensibility to the delights of the palate was probably inherent. It would have been kept in check, however, and even converted into an accomplishment and one of the thousand modes of intellectual culture, had his more ethereal characteristics retained their vigor. But as it existed now, the effect was painful and made Phoebe droop her eyes. In a little while, the guest became sensible of the fragrance of the yet untasted coffee. He quaffed it eagerly. The subtle essence acted on him like a charm draught, and caused the opaque substance of his animal being to grow transparent, or at least translucent, so that a spiritual gleam was transmitted through it with a clearer luster than hitherto. "More! More!" he cried, with a nervous haste in his utterance, as if anxious to retain his grasp of what sought to escape him. "This is what I need! Give me more!" Under this delicate and powerful influence, he sat more erect and looked out from his eyes with a glance that took note of what it rested on. It was not so much that his expression grew more intellectual. This, though it had its share, was not the most peculiar effect. Neither was what we call the moral nature so forcibly awakened as to present itself in remarkable prominence. But a certain fine temper of being was now not brought out in full relief, but changeably and imperfectly betrayed, of which it was the function to deal with all beautiful and enjoyable things. In a character where it should exist as the chief attribute, it would bestow on its possessor an exquisite taste and an enviable susceptibility of happiness. Beauty would be his life. His aspirations would all tend towards it, and allowing his frame and physical organs to be in consonance, his own developments would likewise be beautiful. Such a man should have nothing to do with sorrow, nothing with strife, nothing with the martyrdom which, in an infinite variety of shapes, awaits those who have the heart and will and conscience to fight a battle with the world. To these heroic tempers such martyrdom is the richest meed in the world's gift. To the individual before us it could only be a grief, intense in due proportion with the severity of the infliction. He had no right to be a martyr, and beholding him so fit to be happy and so feeble for all other purposes, a generous, strong, and noble spirit would, methinks, have been ready to sacrifice what little enjoyment it might have planned for itself. It would have flung down the hopes, so paltry in its regard, if thereby the wintry blasts of our rude sphere might come tempered to such a man. Not to speak it harshly or scornfully, it seemed Clifford's nature to be a sybarite. It was perceptible even there in the dark old parlour, in the inevitable polarity with which his eyes were attracted towards the quivering play of sunbeams through the shadowy foliage. It was seen in his appreciating notice of the vase of flowers, the scent of which he inhaled with a zest almost peculiar to a physical organization so refined that spiritual ingredients are moulded in with it. It was betrayed in the unconscious smile with which he regarded Phoebe, whose fresh and maidenly figure was both sunshine and flowers, their essence in a prettier and more agreeable mode of manifestation. Not less evident was this love and necessity for the beautiful in the instinctive caution with which, even so soon, his eyes turned away from his hostess and wandered to any quarter rather than come back. It was Hepzibah's misfortune, not Clifford's fault. How could he, so yellow as she was, so wrinkled, so sad of mien, with that odd uncouthness of a turban on her head, and that most perverse of scowls contorting her brow, how could he love to gaze at her? But did he owe her no affection for so much as she had silently given? He owed her nothing. A nature like Clifford's can contract no debts of that kind. It is, we say it without censure, nor in diminution of the claim which it indefeasibly possesses on beings of another mould, it is always selfish in its essence, and we must give it leave to be so, and heap up our heroic and disinterested love upon it so much the more, without a recompense. Poor Hepzibah knew this truth, or at least acted on the instinct of it. So long estranged from what was lovely, as Clifford had been, she rejoiced, though with a present sigh and a secret purpose to shed tears in her own chamber, that he had brighter objects now before his eyes than her aged and uncomely features. They never possessed a charm, and if they had, the canker of her grief for him would long since have destroyed it. The guest leaned back in his chair. Mingled in his countenance with a dreamy delight, there was a troubled look of effort and unrest. He was seeking to make himself more fully sensible of the scene around him, or perhaps dreading it to be a dream or a play of imagination, was vexing the fair moment with a struggle for some added brilliancy and more durable illusion.
"How pleasant, how delightful," he murmured,
but not as if addressing anyone.
"Will it last? How balmy the atmosphere through that open window. An open window! How beautiful that play of sunshine! Those flowers, how very fragrant! That young girl's face, how cheerful, how blooming! A flower with the dew on it and sunbeams in the dewdrops. Ah, this must be all a dream, a dream, a dream! But it has quite hidden the four stone walls."
Then his face darkened, as if the shadow of a cavern or a dungeon had come over it. There was no more light in its expression than might have come through the iron grates of a prison window. Still lessening, too, as if he were sinking farther into the depths. Phoebe, being of that quickness and activity of temperament that she seldom long refrained from taking a part, and generally a good one, in what was going forward, now felt herself moved to address the stranger.
"Here is a new kind of rose which I found this morning in the garden," said she, choosing a small crimson one from among the flowers in the vase. "There will be but five or six on the bush this season. This is the most perfect of them all, not a speck of blight or mildew in it. And how sweet it is, sweet like no other rose. One can never forget that scent."
"Ah, let me see, let me hold it," cried the guest, eagerly seizing the flower,
which by the spell peculiar to remembered odors brought innumerable associations along with the fragrance that it exhaled.
"Thank you. This has done me good. I remember how I used to prize this flower. Long ago, I suppose, very long ago. Or was it only yesterday? It makes me feel young again. Am I young? Either this remembrance is singularly distinct, or this consciousness strangely dim. But how kind of the fair young girl! Thank you, thank you!"
The favorable excitement derived from the little crimson rose afforded Clifford the brightest moment which he enjoyed at the breakfast table. It might have lasted longer, but that his eyes happened soon afterwards to rest on the face of the old Puritan, who, out of his dingy frame and lustreless canvas, was looking down on the scene like a ghost, and a most ill-tempered and ungenial one. The guest made an impatient gesture of the hand and addressed Hepzibah with what might easily be recognized as the licensed irritability of a petted member of the family.
"Hepzibah! Hepzibah!" cried he, with no little force and distinctness. "Why do you keep that odious picture on the wall? Yes, yes, that is precisely your taste. I've told you 1,000 times that it was the evil genius of the house, my evil genius particularly. Take it down at once."
"Dear Clifford," said Hepzibah sadly, "you know it cannot be."
"Then at all events," continued he, still speaking with some energy, "pray cover it with a crimson curtain, broad enough to hang in folds, and with a golden border and tassels. I cannot bear it. It must not stare me in the face."
"Yes, dear Clifford. The picture shall be covered," said Hepzibah soothingly. "There is a crimson curtain in a trunk above stairs, a little faded and moth-eaten, I'm afraid, but Phoebe and I will do wonders with it.
This very day, remember," said he,
and then added in a low, self-communing voice,
Why should we live in this dismal house at all? Why not go to the south of France, to Italy, Paris, Naples, Venice, Rome? Hepzibah will say we have not the means. A droll idea, that.
He smiled to himself and threw a glance of fine, sarcastic meaning towards Hepzibah. But the several moods of feeling, faintly as they were marked, through which he had passed, occurring in so brief an interval of time, had evidently wearied the stranger. He was probably accustomed to a sad monotony of life, not so much flowing in a stream, however sluggish, as stagnating in a pool around his feet. A slumberous veil diffused itself over his countenance, and had an effect, morally speaking, on its naturally delicate and elegant outline, like that which a brooding mist with no sunshine in it throws over the features of a landscape. He appeared to become grosser, almost cloddish. If aught of interest or beauty, even ruined beauty, had heretofore been visible in this man, the beholder might now begin to doubt it, and to accuse his own imagination of deluding him with whatever grace had flickered over that visage, and whatever exquisite luster had gleamed in those filmy eyes. Before he had quite sunken away, however, the sharp and peevish tinkle of the shop bell made itself audible, striking most disagreeably on Clifford's auditory organs and the characteristic sensibility of his nerves, it caused him to start upright out of his chair.
"Good heavens, Hepzibah, what horrible disturbance have we now in the house!"
cried he, wreaking his resentful impatience, as a matter of course in a custom of old, on the one person in the world that loved him.
"I've never heard such a hateful clamor. Why do you permit it? In the name of all dissonance, what can it be?"
It was very remarkable into what prominent relief, even as if a dim picture should leap suddenly from its canvas, Clifford's character was thrown by this apparently trifling annoyance. The secret was that an individual of his temper can always be pricked more acutely through his sense of the beautiful and harmonious than through his heart. It is even possible, for similar cases have often happened, that if Clifford in his foregoing life had enjoyed the means of cultivating his taste to its utmost perfectibility, that subtle attribute might, before this period, have completely eaten out or filed away his affections. Shall we venture to pronounce, therefore, that his long and black calamity may not have had a redeeming drop of mercy at the bottom?
"Dear Clifford, I wish I could keep the sound from your ears," said Hepzibah patiently, but reddening with a painful suffusion of shame. "It is very disagreeable, even to me, but do you know, Clifford, I have something to tell you. This ugly noise—pray run, Phoebe, and see who is there—this naughty little tinkle is nothing but our shop bell."
"Shop bell?"
repeated Clifford with a bewildered stare.
"Yes, our shop bell," said Hepzibah,
a certain natural dignity mingled with deep emotion now asserting itself in her manner.
"For you must know, dearest Clifford, that we are very poor, and there is no other resource but either to accept assistance from a hand that I would push aside, and so would you, were it to offer bread when we were dying for it, no help save from him, or else to earn our subsistence with my own hands. Alone I might have been content to starve, but you were to be given back to me. Do you think, then, dear Clifford," added she with a wretched smile, "that I have brought an irretrievable disgrace on the old house by opening a little shop in the front gable? Our great-great-grandfather did the same when there was far less need. Are you ashamed of me?"
"Shame? Disgrace? Do you speak these words to me, Hepzibah?" said Clifford.
Not angrily, however, for when a man's spirit has been thoroughly crushed, he may be peevish at small offences, but never resentful of great ones. So he spoke with only a grieved emotion.
"It was not kind to say so, Hepzibah. What shame can befall me now?"
And then the unnerved man, he that had been born for enjoyment, but had met a doom so very wretched, burst into a woman's passion of tears. It was of but brief continuance, however, soon leaving him in a quiescent, and to judge by his countenance, not an uncomfortable state. From this mood, too, he partially rallied for an instant, and looked at Hepzibah with a smile, the keen, half-derisory purport of which was a puzzle to her.
"Are we so very poor, Hepzibah?" said he.
Finally, his chair being deep and softly cushioned, Clifford fell asleep. Hearing the more regular rise and fall of his breath, which, however, even then, instead of being strong and full, had a feeble kind of tremor corresponding with the lack of vigor in his character, hearing these tokens of settled slumber, Hepzibah seized the opportunity to peruse his face more attentively than she had yet dared to do. Her heart melted away in tears. Her profoundest spirit sent forth a moaning voice, low, gentle, but inexpressibly sad. In this depth of grief and pity, she felt that there was no irreverence in gazing at his altered, aged, faded, ruined face. But no sooner was she a little relieved than her conscience smote her for gazing curiously at him, now that he was so changed, and turning hastily away, Hepzibah let down the curtain over the sunny window and left Clifford to slumber there.
8. The Pynchon of Today. Phoebe, on entering the shop, beheld there the already familiar face of the little devourer, if we can reckon his mighty deeds aright, of Jim Crow, the elephant, the camel, the dromedaries, and the locomotive. Having expended his private fortune on the two preceding days in the purchase of the above unheard-of luxuries, the young gentleman's present errand was on the part of his mother, in quest of 3 eggs and 1/2 pound of raisins. These articles Phoebe accordingly supplied, and as a mark of gratitude for his previous patronage, and a slight superadded morsel after breakfast, put likewise into his hand a whale. The great fish, reversing his experience with the prophet of Nineveh, immediately began his progress down the same red pathway of fate, whither so varied a caravan had preceded him. This remarkable urchin, in truth, was the very emblem of old Father Time, both in respect of his all-devouring appetite for men and things, and because he, as well as Time, after engulfing thus much of creation, looked almost as youthful as if he had been just that moment made. After partly closing the door, the child turned back and mumbled something to Phoebe, which, as the whale was but half disposed of, she could not perfectly understand.
"What did you say, my little fellow?" asked she.
"Mother wants to know," repeated Ned Higgins, more distinctly, "how old Maid Pynchon's brother does. Folks say he's caught home."
"My cousin Hepzibah's brother?" exclaimed Phoebe, surprised at this sudden explanation of the relationship between Hepzibah and her guest. "Her brother? And where can he have been?"
The little boy only put his thumb to his broad snub nose, with that look of shrewdness which a child spending much of his time in the street so soon learns to throw over his features, however unintelligent in themselves. Then, as Phoebe continued to gaze at him, without answering his mother's message, he took his departure. As the child went down the steps, a gentleman ascended them and made his entrance into the shop. It was the portly, and had it possessed the advantage of a little more height, would have been the stately figure of a man considerably in the decline of life, dressed in a black suit of some thin stuff, resembling broadcloth as closely as possible. A gold-headed cane of rare oriental wood added materially to the high respectability of his aspect, as did also a neckcloth of the utmost snowy purity, and the conscientious polish of his boots. His dark, square countenance, with its almost shaggy depth of eyebrows, was naturally impressive, and would perhaps have been rather stern had not the gentleman considerately taken upon himself to mitigate the harsh effect by a look of exceeding good humor and benevolence. Owing, however, to a somewhat massive accumulation of animal substance about the lower region of his face, the look was perhaps unctuous rather than spiritual, and had, so to speak, a kind of fleshly effulgence, not altogether so satisfactory as he doubtless intended it to be. A susceptible observer, at any rate, might have regarded it as affording very little evidence of the general benignity of soul whereof it purported to be the outward reflection. And if the observer chanced to be ill-natured as well as acute and susceptible, he would probably suspect that the smile on the gentleman's face was a good deal akin to the shine on his boots, and that each must have cost him and his bootblack respectively a good deal of hard labor to bring out and preserve them. As the stranger entered the little shop, where the projection of the second story and the thick foliage of the elm tree, as well as the commodities at the window, created a sort of grey medium, his smile grew as intense as if he had set his heart on counteracting the whole gloom of the atmosphere, besides any moral gloom pertaining to Hepzibah and her inmates, by the unassisted light of his countenance. On perceiving a young rosebud of a girl instead of the gaunt presence of the old maid, a look of surprise was manifest. He at first knit his brows, then smiled with more unctuous benignity than ever. "Ah, I see how it is," said he, in a deep voice, a voice which, had it come from the throat of an uncultivated man, would have been gruff, but by dint of careful training was now sufficiently agreeable. "I was not aware that Miss Hepzibah Pynchon had commenced business under such favourable auspices. You are her assistant, I suppose?"
"I certainly am," answered Phoebe,
and added with a little air of ladylike assumption, for civil as the gentleman was, he evidently took her to be a young person serving for wages,
"I am a cousin of Miss Hepzibah, on a visit to her."
"Her cousin, and from the country? Pray pardon me, then,"
said the gentleman, bowing and smiling, as Phoebe never had been bowed to nor smiled on before.
"In that case we must be better acquainted, for unless I am sadly mistaken, you are my own little kinswoman likewise. Let me see, Mary, Dolly, Phoebe. Yes, Phoebe is the name. Is it possible that you are Phoebe Pynchon, only child of my dear cousin and classmate Arthur?" "Ha! I see your father now about your mouth. Yes, yes, we must be better acquainted. I am your kinsman, my dear. Surely you must have heard of Judge Pynchon?"
As Phoebe curtsied in reply, the judge bent forward with the pardonable and even praiseworthy purpose, considering the nearness of blood and the difference of age, of bestowing on his young relative a kiss of acknowledged kindred and natural affection. Unfortunately, without design, or only with such instinctive design as gives no account of itself to the intellect, Phoebe, just at the critical moment, drew back, so that her highly respectable kinsman, with his body bent over the counter and his lips protruded, was betrayed into the rather absurd predicament of kissing the empty air. It was a modern parallel to the case of Ixion embracing a cloud, and was so much the more ridiculous as the judge prided himself on eschewing all airy matter and never mistaking a shadow for a substance. The truth was, and it is Phoebe's only excuse, that although Judge Pynchon's glowing benignity might not be absolutely unpleasant to the feminine beholder, with the width of a street or even an ordinary-sized room interposed between, yet it became quite too intense when this dark, full-fed physiognomy, so roughly bearded too that no razor could ever make it smooth, sought to bring itself into actual contact with the object of its regards. The man, the sex, somehow or other, was entirely too prominent in the judge's demonstrations of that sort. Phoebe's eyes sank, and without knowing why, she felt herself blushing deeply under his look. Yet she had been kissed before, and without any particular squeamishness, by perhaps half a dozen different cousins, younger as well as older than this dark-browed, grizzly-bearded, white-neck-clothed, and unctuously benevolent judge, then why not by him? On raising her eyes, Phoebe was startled by the change in Judge Pynchon's face. It was quite as striking, allowing for the difference of scale, as that betwixt a landscape under a broad sunshine and just before a thunderstorm. Not that it had the passionate intensity of the latter aspect, but was cold, hard, immitigable, like a day-long brooding cloud.
"Dear me, what is to be done now?" thought the country girl to herself. "He looks as if there were nothing softer in him than a rock, nor milder than the east wind. I meant no harm. Since he is really my cousin, I would have let him kiss me if I could."
Then, all at once, it struck Phoebe that this very Judge Pynchon was the original of the miniature which the daguerreotypist had shown her in the garden, and that the hard, stern, relentless look now on his face was the same that the sun had so inflexibly persisted in bringing out. Was it therefore no momentary mood, but, however skillfully concealed, the settled temper of his life? And not merely so, but was it hereditary in him, and transmitted down as a precious heirloom from that bearded ancestor in whose picture both the expression and, to a singular degree, the features of the modern judge were shown as by a kind of prophecy? A deeper philosopher than Phoebe might have found something very terrible in this idea. It implied that the weaknesses and defects, the bad passions, the mean tendencies, and the moral diseases which lead to crime are handed down from one generation to another by a far surer process of transmission than human law has been able to establish in respect to the riches and honors which it seeks to entail upon posterity. But as it happened, scarcely had Phoebe's eyes rested again on the judge's countenance than all its ugly sternness vanished, and she found herself quite overpowered by the sultry dog-day heat, as it were, of benevolence, which this excellent man diffused out of his great heart into the surrounding atmosphere, very much like a serpent, which, as a preliminary to fascination, is said to fill the air with his peculiar odor.
"I like that, Cousin Phoebe," cried he, with an emphatic nod of approbation. "I like it much, my little cousin. You are a good child, and know how to take care of yourself. A young girl, especially if she be a very pretty one, can never be too chary of her lips."
"Indeed, sir," said Phoebe, trying to laugh the matter off. "I did not mean to be unkind."
Nevertheless, whether or no it were entirely owing to the inauspicious commencement of their acquaintance, she still acted under a certain reserve, which was by no means customary to her frank and genial nature. The fantasy would not quit her that the original Puritan of whom she had heard so many somber traditions, the progenitor of the whole race of New England Pynchons, the founder of the House of the Seven Gables, and who had died so strangely in it, had now stepped into the shop. In these days of off-hand equipment, the matter was easily enough arranged. On his arrival from the other world, he had merely found it necessary to spend a quarter of an hour at the barber's, who had trimmed down the Puritan's full beard into a pair of grizzled whiskers. Then, patronizing a ready-made clothing establishment, he had exchanged his velvet doublet and sable cloak, with the richly worked band under his chin, for a white collar and cravat, coat, vest, and pantaloons. And lastly, putting aside his steel-hilted broadsword to take up a gold-headed cane, the Colonel Pynchon of 2 centuries ago steps forward as the judge of the passing moment. Of course, Phoebe was far too sensible a girl to entertain this idea in any other way than as a matter for a smile. Possibly also, could the two personages have stood together before her eye, many points of difference would have been perceptible, and perhaps only a general resemblance. The long lapse of intervening years, in a climate so unlike that which had fostered the ancestral Englishman, must inevitably have wrought important changes in the physical system of his descendant. The judge's volume of muscle could hardly be the same as the colonel's. There was undoubtedly less beef in him. Though looked upon as a weighty man among his contemporaries in respect of animal substance, and as favored with a remarkable degree of fundamental development, well adapting him for the judicial bench, we conceive that the modern Judge Pynchon, if weighed in the same balance with his ancestor, would have required at least an old-fashioned 56 to keep the scale in equilibrio. Then the judge's face had lost the ruddy English hue that showed its warmth through all the duskiness of the colonel's weather-beaten cheek, and had taken a sallow shade, the established complexion of his countrymen. If we mistake not, moreover, a certain quality of nervousness had become more or less manifest, even in so solid a specimen of Puritan descent as the gentleman now under discussion. As one of its effects, it bestowed on his countenance a quicker mobility than the old Englishman's had possessed, and keener vivacity, but at the expense of a sturdier something, on which these acute endowments seemed to act like dissolving acids. This process, for aught we know, may belong to the great system of human progress, which, with every ascending footstep, as it diminishes the necessity for animal force, may be destined gradually to spiritualize us by refining away our grosser attributes of body. If so,
Judge Pynchon could endure a century or two more of such refinement, as well as most other men. The similarity, intellectual and moral, between the judge and his ancestor appears to have been at least as strong as the resemblance of mien and feature could afford reason to anticipate. In old Colonel Pynchon's funeral discourse, the clergyman absolutely canonized his deceased parishioner, and opening, as it were, a vista through the roof of the church, and thence through the firmament above, showed him seated, harp in hand, among the crowned choristers of the spiritual world. On his tombstone, too, the record is highly eulogistic, nor does history, so far as he holds a place upon its page, assail the consistency and uprightness of his character. So also, as regards the Judge Pynchon of today, neither clergyman nor legal critic nor inscriber of tombstones nor historian of general or local politics would venture a word against this eminent person's sincerity as a Christian, or respectability as a man, or integrity as a judge, or courage and faithfulness as the often-tried representative of his political party. But besides these cold, formal, and empty words of the chisel that inscribes, the voice that speaks, and the pen that writes, for the public eye and for distant time, and which inevitably lose much of their truth and freedom by the fatal consciousness of so doing, there were traditions about the ancestor, and private diurnal gossip about the judge, remarkably accordant in their testimony. It is often instructive to take the woman's, the private and domestic, view of a public man, nor can anything be more curious than the vast discrepancy between portraits intended for engraving and the pencil sketches that pass from hand to hand behind the original's back. For example, tradition affirmed that the Puritan had been greedy of wealth. The judge, too, with all the show of liberal expenditure, was said to be as close-fisted as if his gripe were of iron. The ancestor had clothed himself in a grim assumption of kindliness, a rough heartiness of word and manner, which most people took to be the genuine warmth of nature, making its way through the thick and inflexible hide of a manly character. His descendant, in compliance with the requirements of a nicer age, had etherealized this rude benevolence into that broad benignity of smile wherewith he shone like a noonday's sun along the streets, or glowed like a household fire in the drawing-rooms of his private acquaintance. The Puritan, if not belied by some singular stories, murmured even at this day under the narrator's breath, had fallen into certain transgressions, to which men of his great animal development, whatever their faith or principles, must continue liable, until they put off impunity along with the gross earthly substance that involves it. We must not stain our page with any contemporary scandal to a similar purport that may have been whispered against the judge. The Puritan, again an autocrat in his own household, had worn out three wives, and merely by the remorseless weight and hardness of his character in the conjugal relation had sent them one after another broken-hearted to their graves. Here the parallel, in some sort, fails. The judge had wedded but a single wife, and lost her in the third or fourth year of their marriage. There was a fable, however, for such we choose to consider it, though not impossibly typical of Judge Pynchon's marital deportment, that the lady got her death blow in the honeymoon and never smiled again, because her husband compelled her to serve him with coffee every morning at his bedside in token of fealty to her liege lord and master. But it is too fruitful a subject, this of hereditary resemblances, the frequent recurrence of which in a direct line is truly unaccountable, when we consider how large an accumulation of ancestry lies behind every man at the distance of one or two centuries. We shall only add, therefore, that the Puritan, so at least says chimney-corner tradition, which often preserves traits of character with marvelous fidelity, was bold, imperious, relentless, crafty, laying his purposes deep and following them out with an inveteracy of pursuit that knew neither rest nor conscience, trampling on the weak and, when essential to his ends, doing his utmost to beat down the strong. Whether the judge, in any degree, resembled him, the further progress of our narrative may show. Scarcely any of the items in the above-drawn parallel occurred to Phoebe, whose country birth and residence, in truth, had left her pitifully ignorant of most of the family traditions, which lingered like cobwebs and incrustations of smoke about the rooms and chimney corners of the House of the Seven Gables. Yet there was a circumstance, very trifling in itself, which impressed her with an odd degree of horror. She had heard of the anathema flung by Maul, the executed wizard, against Colonel Pynchon and his posterity, that God would give them blood to drink, and likewise of the popular notion that this miraculous blood might now and then be heard gurgling in their throats. The latter scandal, as became a person of sense, and more especially a member of the Pynchon family, Phoebe had set down for the absurdity which it unquestionably was. But ancient superstitions, after being steeped in human hearts and embodied in human breath, and passing from lip to ear in manifold repetition through a series of generations, become imbued with an effect of homely truth. The smoke of the domestic hearth has scented them through and through. By long transmission among household facts, they grow to look like them and have such a familiar way of making themselves at home that their influence is usually greater than we suspect. Thus it happened that when Phoebe heard a certain noise in Judge Pynchon's throat, rather habitual with him, not altogether voluntary, yet indicative of nothing, unless it were a slight bronchial complaint, or, as some people hinted, an apoplectic symptom, when the girl heard this queer and awkward ingurgitation, which the writer never did hear and therefore cannot describe, she, very foolishly, started and clasped her hands. Of course, it was exceedingly ridiculous in Phoebe to be discomposed by such a trifle, and still more unpardonable to show her discomposure to the individual most concerned in it. But the incident chimed in so oddly with her previous fancies about the colonel and the judge that for the moment it seemed quite to mingle their identity.
"What is the matter with you, young woman?" said Judge Pynchon, giving her one of his harsh looks. "Are you afraid of anything?"
"Oh, nothing, sir, nothing in the world," answered Phoebe, with a little laugh of vexation at herself. "But perhaps you wish to speak with my cousin Hepzibah. Shall I call her?"
"Stay a moment, if you please," said the judge, again beaming sunshine out of his face. "You seem to be a little nervous this morning. The town air, Cousin Phoebe, does not agree with your good, wholesome country habits. Or has anything happened to disturb you? Anything remarkable in Cousin Hepzibah's family? An arrival, eh?" "I thought so. No wonder you are out of sorts, my little cousin. To be an inmate with such a guest may well startle an innocent young girl."
"You quite puzzle me, sir," replied Phoebe, gazing inquiringly at the judge. "There is no frightful guest in the house, but only a poor, gentle, childlike man, whom I believe to be Cousin Hepzibah's brother. I am afraid, but you, sir, will know better than I, that he is not quite in his sound senses, but so mild and quiet he seems to be that a mother might trust her baby with him, and I think he would play with the baby as if he were only a few years older than itself." "He startle me? Oh, no, indeed."
"I rejoice to hear so favorable and so ingenuous an account of my cousin Clifford," said the benevolent judge. "Many years ago, when we were boys and young men together, I had a great affection for him, and still feel a tender interest in all his concerns. You say, Cousin Phoebe, he appears to be weak-minded. Heaven grant him at least enough of intellect to repent of his past sins."
"Nobody, I fancy," observed Phoebe, "can have fewer to repent of."
"And is it possible, my dear," rejoined the judge with a commiserating look, "that you have never heard of Clifford Pynchon, that you know nothing of his history? Well, it is all right, and your mother has shown a very proper regard for the good name of the family with which she connected herself. Believe the best you can of this unfortunate person, and hope the best.
It is a rule which Christians should always follow in their judgments of one another, and especially is it right and wise among near relatives whose characters have necessarily a degree of mutual dependence. But is Clifford in the parlor? I will just step in and see.
Perhaps, sir, I had better call my cousin Hepzibah, said Phoebe,
hardly knowing, however, whether she ought to obstruct the entrance of so affectionate a kinsman into the private regions of the house.
Her brother seemed to be just falling asleep after breakfast, and I am sure she would not like him to be disturbed. Pray, sir, let me give her notice.
But the judge showed a singular determination to enter unannounced, and as Phoebe, with the vivacity of a person whose movements unconsciously answer to her thoughts, had stepped towards the door, he used little or no ceremony in putting her aside.
"No, no, Miss Phoebe," said Judge Pynchon in
a voice as deep as a thunder growl, and with a frown as black as the cloud whence it issues.
"Stay you here. I know the house, and know my cousin Hepzibah, and know her brother Clifford likewise. No need my little country cousin put herself to the trouble of announcing me."
In these latter words, by the by, there were symptoms of a change from his sudden harshness into his previous benignity of manner.
"I am at home here, Phoebe, you must recollect, and you are the stranger. I will just step in, therefore, and see for myself how Clifford is, and assure him and Hepzibah of my kindly feelings and best wishes. It is right at this juncture that they should both hear from my own lips how much I desire to serve them. Ha! Here is Hepzibah herself."
Such was the case. The vibrations of the judge's voice had reached the old gentlewoman in the parlor where she sat, with face averted, waiting on her brother's slumber. She now issued forth, as would appear to defend the entrance, looking, we must needs say, amazingly like the dragon which in fairy tales is wont to be the guardian over an enchanted beauty. The habitual scowl of her brow was undeniably too fierce at this moment to pass itself off on the innocent score of nearsightedness, and it was bent on Judge Pynchon in a way that seemed to confound, if not alarm, him, so inadequately had he estimated the moral force of a deeply grounded antipathy. She made a repelling gesture with her hand, and stood a perfect picture of prohibition at full length in the dark frame of the doorway. But we must betray Hepzibah's secret, and confess that the native timorousness of her character even now developed itself in a quick tremor, which to her own perceptions set each of her joints at variance with its fellows. Possibly the judge was aware how little true hardihood lay behind Hepzibah's formidable front. At any rate, being a gentleman of steady nerves, he soon recovered himself, and failed not to approach his cousin with outstretched hand, adopting the sensible precaution, however, to cover his advance with a smile so broad and sultry that, had it been only half as warm as it looked, a trellis of grapes might at once have turned purple under its summer-like exposure. It may have been his purpose, indeed, to melt poor Hepzibah on the spot as if she were a figure of yellow wax.
"Hepzibah, my beloved cousin, I am rejoiced," exclaimed the judge most emphatically. "Now, at length, you have something to live for. Yes, and all of us, let me say, your friends and kindred, have more to live for than we had yesterday. I have lost no time in hastening to offer any assistance in my power towards making Clifford comfortable. He belongs to us all. I know how much he requires, how much he used to require, with his delicate taste and his love of the beautiful. Anything in my house, pictures, books, wine, luxuries of the table, he may command them all. It would afford me most heartfelt gratification to see him. Shall I step in this moment?"
"No," replied Hepzibah, her voice quivering too painfully to allow of many words. "He cannot see visitors."
"A visitor, my dear cousin, do you call me so?" cried the judge, whose sensibility, it seems, was hurt by the coldness of the phrase. "Nay, then, let me be Clifford's host, and your own likewise. Come at once to my house. The country air and all the conveniences, I may say luxuries, that I have gathered about me will do wonders for him.
and you and I, dear Hepzibah, will consult together and watch together and labor together to make our dear Clifford happy. Come, why should we make more words about what is both a duty and a pleasure on my part? Come to me at once."
On hearing these so hospitable offers and such generous recognition of the claims of kindred, Phoebe felt very much in the mood of running up to Judge Pynchon and giving him of her own accord the kiss from which she had so recently shrunk away. It was quite otherwise with Hepzibah. The judge's smile seemed to operate on her acerbity of heart like sunshine upon vinegar, making it 10 times sourer than ever.
"Clifford,"
said she, still too agitated to utter more than an abrupt sentence,
"Clifford has a home here."
"May heaven forgive you, Hepzibah,"
said Judge Pynchon, reverently lifting his eyes towards that high court of equity to which he appealed,
"if you suffer any ancient prejudice or animosity to weigh with you in this matter. I stand here with an open heart, willing and anxious to receive yourself and Clifford into it. Do not refuse my good offices, my earnest propositions for your welfare. They are such in all respects as it behooves your nearest kinsman to make. It will be a heavy responsibility, cousin, if you confine your brother to this dismal house and stifled air, when the delightful freedom of my country's seat is at his command."
"It would never suit Clifford," said Hepzibah, as briefly as before.
"Woman," broke forth the judge, giving way to his resentment, "what is the meaning of all this? Have you other resources? Nay, I suspected as much. Take care, Hepzibah, take care. Clifford is on the brink of as black a ruin as ever befell him yet. But why do I talk with you, woman as you are? Make way, I must see Clifford."
Hepzibah spread out her gaunt figure across the door, and seemed really to increase in bulk, looking the more terrible also because there was so much terror and agitation in her heart.
But Judge Pynchon's evident purpose of forcing a passage was interrupted by a voice from the inner room, a weak, tremulous, wailing voice, indicating helpless alarm, with no more energy for self-defense than belongs to a frightened infant.
"Hepzibah! Hepzibah!" cried the voice. "Go down on your knees to him. Kiss his feet. Entreat him not to come in. Oh, let him have mercy on me. Mercy, mercy!"